We are back, and what's this? An Oscars retrospective podcast that actually is doing an Oscars retrospective. That is amazing.
The pod that was promised, long promised.
Yeah, long ago. We're talking about the 1989-1990 Best Original Screenplay category. It's been a while since we've done a full-fledged Oscars retrospective, but we figured, having covered basically everything we can and dragged our feet enough with the current events and the Marvel movies and everything else that we've done lately, it's time to actually get back to it and talk about what brought us to the dance here. So we're going to talk about the golden statues and who they were given out to. And in this case, like we said, we are talking about the 1990 Oscars and the category of Best Original Screenplay, which was won, for those of you who don't know, by the movie Dead Poets Society.
Over. Yeah.
What this category is like a celebration of date rape and then do the right thing. Right? Like, that's what this category is.
There are horrible things being done by characters in these stories.
By protagonists.
By directors who have made these stories. By screenwriters who have written these stories. And then there's Spike Lee and do the right thing.
Yeah, some of these do not age well, and we'll get into those in all their glory.
I like Rob Reiner, though, too. I mean,
he's a good dude. He made a movie about a stalker.
Steven Soderbergh, too.
Beloved movie about a stalker. I am your co-host, Mike One. This is my co-host, also Mike.
Also Mike here. And yeah, a lot of parallels for this category going into this next year of movie going. You have Thomas Shulman, who supposedly ended the career of Joe Pesci, not having done that with The Irishman coming out.
Yeah, he's making a little comeback, but we also saw his comeback in The Good Shepherd and how that turned out.
So. More on this later. We got Spike Lee, of course, Black Klansman, making waves at the Cannes Film Festival. We just went over that in our big
Hollywood Hot Takes episode. Yeah, it's going to be probably going to be something that's talked about for Best Picture.
Woody Allen is pariah number one.
If not one, then in the top three right now.
Which is crazy because he could have had a monstrous hit on his hands with Rainy Day New York, with Timothy Chalamet, the hottest actor going, with Ellie Fanning as well. I mean, he was going to have another Woody Allen-sized hit like he did with three out of the last six movies he's done.
It feels like every big actor that had their moment in the sun last year had to come out and apologize for working with Woody Allen. So that's going to be tough to get over for him, I would think.
And Steven Soderbergh came back to making movies this year, last year, with Logan Lucky, Unsane, that I liked for sure, Claire Foy in that, and Ocean's 8, his Ocean's franchise, not that it was his, way back to Sinatra, but it's being remade into Sandra Bullock, Cate
Blanchett.
Summer
blockbuster coming out soon. Yeah, well, the old woman remake.
A lot of parallels.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and you're absolutely right. It's very relevant to what's going on today and what hopefully will be going on as we get towards the 2019 Oscars. We're going to start the 1989-1990 retrospective. It's been a while, but just to remind you, when we do a Best Picture or a Best Original Screenplay category, we're doing full spoilers into those. You're going to hear all about the movie, the twists and turns fully throughout. We're going to do our best to try to delineate where the spoilers are, but you're not going to have the big dance breakdown like we usually do for our Oscars sprint profiles. You're just kind of going to weave the spoilers in throughout what we're talking about just as a means of conversation. So if that's a problem for you, you're going to want to try to avoid those. We'll do our best to try to set them off, but
exactly. We'll see what happens. Two things on that. You can look at the show notes and navigate which movies you want spoiled, which movies you don't mind, which movies you've seen already. Another thing, though, I mean, we're not going to break down necessarily the huge whammy moments or tell you why we loved the best moments of these scenes and whatnot. I don't think we do that and kind of ruin the jokes if there's a great joke.
It's a screenplay diagnosis. We're here to talk about what the actual writer did and how their story worked and failed. So we don't have to.
Some of them succeeded.
Oh, they failed.
But listen, I mean, I think in many ways, even if you have not seen these movies, you can enjoy them after listening to our pod. I think that's, I've heard that from a lot of people and who've listened to our stuff. And then definitely, you know, like the Marvel, we were all spoilers for those. Mm-hmm. And people listen to those at a good clip anyway as well. So take it what it is. It is a spoiler-filled pod.
So let's start off, like we always do with every retrospective, on a light, happy, and uplifting note.
Here's the thing about this. People don't know to be afraid of this because it's been
true.
So
it's
long.
Been a while. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
I just realized this morning, oh my God, he's doing a year in review. I should be very afraid.
I have to warn everybody.
I'm going to make sure I'm hydrated so my brain can take all
this. Yeah, yeah. So unfortunately, we started off doing a bunch of retrospectives. Like we said, it's been a while. The year in review is how we start off to kind of tell you the backdrop against which all these movies were seen in their day. It just so happens that the years that we review are always like really sad, have really terrible things that have happened.
I think whoever updates the Wikipedia, they don't have a lot going on in their lives.
Listen to heavy metal in a dark room when
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Who's going to take the time to update Wikipedia? Not the happy person who's on the beach with their loved ones day in, day out. It's whoever's just like, oh, this tragedy happened in the summer of 1989.
But if that's you and you're listening, we love you.
We thank you, because we couldn't have a podcast without you, but maybe we can cheer you up
so
a little bit.
So let's start off with a death right away.
Not this part.
January of 1989, Hirohito, the longtime emperor of Japan, passes away. He's succeeded by Akihito. The European nations banded together to make a concerted effort towards strengthening human rights and an east-west trade. That's something positive.
Oh, some of that was good, some of that was bad. You jammed them together, though.
Yeah, well, it gets worse.
Make
a very,
me happy.
Very famous Stockton schoolyard shooting in California. Patrick Purdy killed 5 children and then himself after injuring another 30. I know, it's terrible. And George H.W. Bush sworn in as president in January.
It doesn't get
any better. February, international leadership changing either via uprising, such as in Portugal, death, such as in South Africa, or election, as was the case in Jamaica. So a lot of leadership changing hinges throughout the world. The Ayatollah of Iran issues a fatwa, or death warrant, for Salman Rushdie for publishing his novel Satanic Verses, would place a $3 million bounty on him. And this was interesting because when we first recorded this episode, we're re-recording it now years later. When we first recorded it, I mispronounced the word fatwa, which was, you know, great for us.
But you watched the last season of
and
Curb Your Enthusiasm.
And it became an actual plot line in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Also, the first GPS satellite was launched, so it's our first step to the future here in 1989 in February. March of 89, Iceland ends a 74-year ban on beer. That's positive.
So what did they drink? Ice?
Because Iceland, is that what you did? Is that what joke there? Do you feel happy about that? Are you proud of yourself?
Well, I did. I did wake up this morning and with wide eyes and twinkles in them say, I'm going to make this Iceland joke because Icelanders drink ice.
You had a year to prepare that one line.
I hope Mike likes it. But I guess not.
I'm sorry for shitting all over that. George H.W. Bush banned the importing of assault rifles. There's a novel concept. April of 89. Yeah. The U.S. government seizes the Irvine, California, Lincoln Savings and Loan Association, Charles Keating, for whom the Keating Five were named, eventually goes to jail as part
Keating,
of the massive 1980 saving and loan crisis.
Is the name of one of our characters in
sure
these
is.
Movies.
It may not be a coincidence. I don't know. Tiananmen Square also famously began.
It better be a coincidence. If he based it on the savings and loan crisis, that would make a lot of sense, actually.
In August, something near and dear to our hearts, the Sega Genesis is released. And also, you know, we
good
go
transition.
Positive, negative, positive, negative. The Menendez brothers murders have happened.
Just like writing a good scene.
Yeah, right. So,
well, the last house on the left. The last podcast on the left had a good series on the Menendez brothers. Remember that?
They did. NBC also came out with a short run series last season that I guess disappointed a little bit, but I was excited to watch. It wasn't bad. Watch some of it.
It was okay. Edie Falco?
Edie Falco was the lead in that, yes. October of 89, Mike and Oscar favorite Betty Davis unfortunately passes away. We have a couple things in the pipeline about her. We love her. Everybody loves her. She's like the greatest actress of all time. No big deal. November, the first dial-up internet in American history is made by the World STD. Can't imagine why that company didn't stick around.
That's what it was. I was listening to the recording earlier. I was like, wait, what? I know that's a funny phrase, funny acronym. It's funny to a lot of people.
Not
but
if
I
they have gonorrhea.
I didn't get it.
November 17th, the Berlin Wall officially falls. December, we had the first full-length Simpsons episode. January of 1990, we're in the home stretch. First McDonald's opened in Russia, starting their globalization to take over the world. February, we had Nelson Mandela released from prison after 27 years in South Africa. Seems like a big deal. And in March, the final month with communism dead, Mikhail Gorbachev is elected the first president of Russia, and the largest art theft in U.S. history occurs in Boston, which means the paintings that are still unrecovered to this day, accounting for some odd millions of dollars in value.
You're not a great method actor, I just want to say, because your delivery for both the negative things and the positive things was exactly the same.
It's because I am dead inside and have never felt joy nor sorrow.
Like you let off that STD joke, like the same way like Nelson Mandela got out of prison, the same way.
The same weight, Fatwa. In my mind, you know? Okay. Everything's equal.
But I do want to say, yeah, Apple is a better name for a company than STD.
Than the world STD, yeah. The world herpes, thank you.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's the backdrop against which these movies were seen. We're talking about, again, the 1989 Best Original Screenplay.
I need a shower.
That were given out. The Oscars took place March 26, 1990 at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in L.A., which is a pavilion and an arena that hosted many Oscars, I come to find, as we keep doing more and more of these episodes.
Right.
But the host was Billy Crystal. The five movies we're talking about, screenplays we're talking about, I should say, Dead Poets Society, which was the winner, Do the Right Thing, When Harry Met Sally, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and Crimes and Misdemeanors. Dead
Probably
Poets.
A two-part episode coming for you, so we'll have half and half.
Yes.
We'll have our re-rank in the second part.
Yes, you should do all these hosting things that I should say, but I don't. So
I probably jumped the gun there.
No, good. You didn't jump the gun because I was going to ignore it, so good job.
Oh, cool.
So we're going to start doing these in chronologically order, in order that they came out. And oddly enough, the first one that came out chronologically was Dead Poets Society. That's the one that ended up winning the category. Mike is going to start us off with a production profile for Dead Poets Society.
Thomas Shulman, the screenwriter, he's the guy I'm going to bio here. Listen, Thomas Shulman was born 1951 in Nashville, bachelor's of philosophy at Vanderbilt, and he winds up working in theater and film. So essentially, he's the composite of all these characters in Dead Poets.
Had his nose in the air the entire time in his youth.
Yes. Now, he was humbled a little bit early part of his career because he wrote TV movies before...
the horror!
before snagging a job writing in 1989, not one, but two major studio pictures, Dead Poets Society and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
But both beloved movies in certain
absolutely.
Circles.
And Shulman shows some chops pretty early. He only had 7 days to turn Honey, I Shrunk the Kids from a drama, which is a script and a movie I don't want to see or read...
That sounds horrifying.
To a comedy. Yeah, I mean, what is it? Like, the Interspace was even funny.
Yeah, they're just running away from, like, shoes the whole time?
It needed to be rated, like, NC-17. I mean, think about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Right.
It could be a horror movie.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Like, the scariest horror movie ever.
All right.
Or Evie. So, yeah, I mean, he's a talent to turn that waking nightmare into a comedy.
That's
with
nice
Rick
of you
Moranis.
To say, knowing what's coming up. And we're going to preface this by saying Thomas Shulman not going to be someone that's going to be on the Mike
No,
Oscar
because
podcast.
Here's what he's done. Here's what he's done.
Cancel
now, this
Thomas
is a,
Shulman.
This is a perfectly nice man, I'm sure, and he's not.
You don't know that.
I don't know. But here's what he's done to great acting careers.
Yes.
He is like the cooler, William H. Macy style, the guy who, in that movie, walks around at various
casinos,
tables
yeah.
in the casino because he's paid by the people that run the casino to give the bad luck by association.
Is hence, that a real joke? Listen, I'm perfect for that job. By the way.
Well, that's an interesting movie because he's so unlucky until, guess what? Spoiler alert, he becomes lucky.
I thought he was going to have sex with a prostitute.
Well, he does that as well.
All right.
I don't remember if she was a prostitute. Anyway, cut that part. Anyway, William H. Macy. I mean, Thomas Shulman.
I get it.
Writes a movie for Rick Moranis in 1989, who begins the final five-year phase of his career. This, and he's in the prime of it.
Yeah.
As a child movie actor, and he's basically going to retire. This was the beginning of the end for Rick Moranis. So that's one, Mike.
Yeah, he's fallen off the map, too. He just has decided to come out of private life for the SCTV reunion, which either has happened or is happening right. shortly. But we're talking about 20 years.
But truth be told, Shulman killed Moranis.
Yes, he's dead.
Okay, Shulman wrote Second Sight, which was the last ditch effort to make Perfect Strangers TV actor Bronson Pinchot, Me. Who was a big deal at the time, a movie star. It failed.
Sent him straight to the surreal life.
Pinchot was banished to, hence, worse TV,
yeah.
and bit movie parts for the rest of his life. So that's two.
0-2.
Shulman wrote What About Bob?
Great movie.
I
know you have your problems with it. Yes,
hate
I'm sorry.
That movie.
I forgot about this argument we've had.
which may not have killed Bill Murray's career.
Correct.
But we sure as shit don't see Richard Dreyfuss in any more movies, any more comedies for certain.
Yeah, we don't, do we?
That's three.
Yeah, oh boy.
Moranis, Pinchot, Dreyfuss.
Which, also, the only time ever you're going to hear Pinchot with Moranis and Dreyfuss, so that's good to...
Absolutely. We're very unique on this podcast. Medicine Man may not have killed Sean Connery's career.
Yes.
It did put a seven-year funk onto the life of Lorraine Bracco, who doesn't...
She's beloved!
She doesn't rebound until she becomes Dr. Melfi in The Sopranos. She doesn't star in another movie after that.
And she was awesome in Goodfellas,
too.
Here's
the weird, like, reverberations of Shulman's script. Absolutely take Connery out later on.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Connery does stuff for another, like, 15 years, but he retired suddenly.
You're saying Shulman had something to do with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Somewhere in there, we didn't realize, but Shulman's like, hey, Sean, we probably worked together in years past. Read my newest script, maybe? And he reads it, and he's never seen from again. That's four. I'm going to count five.
Shulman wears a cloak that just hides his face, and he points with a skeleton finger. Is that what you're...
Yeah. Moranis, Pinchot, Dreyfuss,
yeah,
Connery, right. Bracco. Like I said in the intro, I don't know if it was eight heads in a duffel bag or gone fishing.
Oh, God.
But I have a hunch.
So sad.
The former was written and directed by Shulman, which it was, and that double jinx, written and directed by Shulman, ended a stellar 2 to 3 good movies a year from Joe Pesci.
Yeah, he was
in the 90s there. So Joe Pesci, number six. But that's not all, folks.
Oh, come on. He's taking out Hollywood.
Pesci, number six. Number seven is Eddie Murphy. In 1998's Holy Man.
You gonna tell me Shulman wrote Norbit?
No, he wrote Holy Man. And if it was not for a talking donkey, Murphy hasn't done anything good since. He's done Norbit.
Hey. He was in Tower Heist.
Ugh.
Oh, God.
So, Shulman, this Walt Whitman reading hack,
oh,
has
God
killed
Lord.
Seven major careers.
Wow.
I got two more. And it's two more great careers in one movie. Now, one like Lorraine Bracco has since rebounded. Here he is, Ray Romano. Ray Romano went into 2004's Welcome to Mooseport thinking he's going to be a movie star.
Right. This is his big turn.
He's got Everybody Loves Raymond going strong. He's going to dive into movies. He's going to go against another great actor in this story. Ray Romano literally does no movies after
Absolutely
this.
Not. And Everybody Loves Raymond dies.
It's canceled a year later.
Oh, God. He reaches into TV.
So that's eight major actors that Shulman has killed. The ninth is an American treasure.
This one hurts you personally.
This man would not act again after this movie.
Oh, God.
The co-star of Welcome to Mooseport, the legend himself, Gene Hackman.
He killed Joe Pesci and Gene Hackman. Oh, no.
So basically, every Thomas Shulman script movie is like the VHS cassette tape from The Ring. Once you see one of these pieces of art, you have 7 days.
Oh, no.
Or 7 years, maybe, but for some. It's terrible. It's true. It's true.
I know. It's tough to beat. It's inexplicable. Let's play devil's advocate. It's inexplicable. Because like we said, some of these, it's not like all these scripts should have killed careers.
I've been explicating it in my brain of late. Because here's the thing.
Right.
And here's our biggest problem that we're going to have with Dead Poets Society. It has no soul. The moral compass of Dead Poets Society is bankrupt.
Well, okay, you're not wrong.
So, the insidious nature
of these evil 30 years
Vanderbilt,
later, Mike.
Vanderbilt psychology, philosophy majors, morality.
Uh-huh.
To tear you down from the inside.
He has flames in his eyes
Mooseport.
Right now.
Welcome to Mooseport sounds like a good movie.
Oh my God, I'm getting a little scared.
It is not a good movie. It is wrong. Just like Dead Poets Society is wrong.
And he got an Oscar for it.
The whole problem. The whole reason we started this podcast probably, in reality, is that we had some beef with the Academy over the years.
Yes, without question. And listen, we're going to talk about how time has treated these movies, and we understand that it's a totally different world in 2018, thank God, than it was in 1989, 1990. But we cannot help but comment on the things we see on film that were made in this time. And there are a couple movies, and this one especially, that has some glaring modern day issues that you wouldn't even make them in movies today, or at least not in a contemporary coming of age, heart-filling moment type story.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape is a movie about a guy making masturbation videos of women. Has better
maybe
moral compass.
Less offensive, yeah.
Less offensive than this movie.
Which isn't hyperbole. I mean, that's not a joke. I know. It's true.
I agree with that statement I said.
So sad. So let's talk about some specs for Dead Poets Society. It debuted June 2nd, 1989, directed by Peter Weir, written by, I forgot the guy's name, that Mike just went on a 20-minute rant about.
Probably a fine fellow.
4 Oscar nominations on the night. It was nominated for Best Picture, Lead Actor for Robin Williams, and Best Director for Peter Weir. The only Oscar it did end up winning, of course, was Best Screen Original Screenplay, like we talk about. A 128-minute runtime produced by Touchstone and distributed by Buena Vista Pictures, made for a budget of $16.4 million, wound up with a total box office take of $235.9 million.
What?
So it did okay for itself.
It did great.
8.1 IMDb rating on 332,000 plus reviews puts it at number 235 in the IMDb top 250, but actually has it tied for 147th, alongside the likes of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, The Sixth Sense, Gone Girl, and The Princess Bride. It carries an 86% certified fresh Rotten Tomato rating on 56 critic scores, with an average of 7.3 out of 10 for those critic scores, and a 92% audience score on 306,000 with an average rating of 3.8 out of 5 for an audience score. We cap it off with a 79 Meta rating from Metacritic. So all across the board, very high marks. Let's talk about the main problem with this movie.
A lot of people have this as their like favorite movie of all time. Well, and one of the people that we admire on award circuit, for that matter.
You can see why, right? It is a coming-of-age movie. It's about these kids at Welton Academy. They're kind of born with a silver spoon in their mouth. They have to basically find their own way as men, and they're being pressured by their parents in different ways. Kurtwood Smith plays the father of Robert Sean Leonard of House fame. He's with this kid named Neil Perry.
Yes.
Neil Perry wants to be an actor. Kurtwood Smith wants him to be a doctor. Todd Anderson is played by a young Ethan Hawke. A lot of young actors that are starting this movie, not unlike Black Hawk Down. Todd Anderson is kind of the silent kid who doesn't really know what he wants to do in life, kind of is a little standoffish, not emo or anything like that, but he's kind of like the square peg in a round hole type deal there. Knox Overstreet, who we're going to talk about a lot, played by a young Josh Charles. He's the romantic of the boys here, or is positioned as the one that is in love with this girl who he meets after being set up at the Danbury residence, which is a rich house that his parents are friends with. He goes there, he meets their young daughter, and is infatuated with her immediately throughout the movie.
He's romantic. He's like being the most tolerant member of the KKK or something.
It's not... not untrue. So what is the Dead Poets Society? Well, John Keating is the Robin Williams character. John Keating is the new English teacher, professor, whatever title you want to give him in this movie. The kids, this group of youngsters, find that he actually went to he actually went to Welton Academy back in his day and started the Dead Poets Society, which was basically just guys being dudes running off into the woods on their own when they're not supposed to and talking about old poets and old, basically the old arts.
Yes, this is how repressed they all were.
Right.
I have several rants, and yes, I can give one of them here. Here's my biggest problem with the movie that I'm actually going to invert the beginning of this episode, because I want it working as a thesis statement. The biggest issue of this movie is that there's a misdiagnosis based on the writing, based in terms of the theme of the movie.
Which is good. You're saying that the screenplay had a flaw at the time, aside from what we're going to talk about with the date rape stuff.
Because this is a great school, and it's a great academic program. It's a great curriculum. It works to a T.
Like all those snobs that went to Fairfield Prep. Right.
Exactly. I mean, this curriculum is second to none.
Yeah.
They do a great job getting kids to Ivy League schools. 75% go to Ivy League schools.
These are the kids that are born with silver spoons and are fed silver spoons throughout their life.
But here's the thing. They don't get into Ivy League schools because of the silver spoons in their pocket. They get there because they work their asses off.
That's also true. Yeah.
Learning this material and being the best students in the country.
Yeah. No,
why
you're absolutely
is that a
right.
bad thing?
Well, it's kind of a common theme that went throughout this movie. Things that were positioned as like the negative or the overbearing or the antagonist of the scene.
Right, are immediately tied to these quote-unquote vocations of the parents, that the parents want them to be lawyers and doctors and great citizens.
Well, I was going to say they're presented as negative just because they're supposed to be negative. Like right. The football player in the infamous scene we're going to talk about, he's just the bad guy because the scene wants him to be a bad guy. Right, it's absurd. So you're absolutely right. It tries to be counter-convention for really no reason at all.
But in fact, in my opinion, the monasticism that they're forced to live through.
What a fucking word.
That's the problem. The fact that they're so repressed socially is the problem. The fact that they're so, tied down beyond their curriculum is the problem. And that has nothing to do with being part of a great school.
No, you're not wrong at all. And these are certainly really repressed kids. It's tough enough to find yourself as an adolescent going through, middle school and high school. Never mind having to do so with the world of pressure that the Kurtwood Smiths of the world were putting
on. It's much better than the problems we have nowadays since the late 80s. But it's also not reflective of the problem with the 80s.
I was going to tell you that. So is that why we view this so negatively, you and I? Because we find it so hard to relate to
It might have been the problem of the 50s, but excess, what's hit the Wall Street markets from the 80s and the savings and loan thing, and also, in 2008 there, you have silver-spooned wealthy kids or whatever, just who are corrupt and are fraudulent in terms of what they do, who don't have the wellspring of knowledge and of real schooling, that just basically go on their father's dime or father's ticket into Wall Street and gamblers and screwing over poor people. That's the real issue of from the 80s to the 2000s. And it's the opposite of this. Like, I would rather have accomplished students actually who know how to shape industries
and want to do something,
who care about these things. Like, this problem was a beautiful problem compared to, it was like, what was that retrospective we did with Holly Hunter? What was that? Broadcast news,
yeah.
The problems of broadcast news pale in comparison to the problems we have with the news industry today.
That's a really good socioeconomic take on it, too.
Yeah, but the problems at Hogwarts and Dead Poets Society here they pale in comparison to what, fucking Animal House culture did with Wall Street guys the next 30 years. So it's bullshit.
Yeah,
so
that's a fantastic take, I will say. That you're absolutely, I think you're nailing it on the head there.
Once in a while, even a blind squirrel. Okay.
Can water ski?
Finds a nut once in a while, yeah.
The whole problem is, so that's the Dead Poets Society, and they try to integrate their meeting with girls. It's how they're growing on their own outside of the walls of Welton. John Keating is such a central figure because he's the new teacher, and we are introduced very quickly that all the professors, are stereotypically 80s professors. They're very stuffy. They're very full of themselves. Their classes are boring.
Yeah, he's basically
the cool teacher.
He's the cool teacher, yeah. And he's basically Thomas Schulman's acting coach. Because Schulman couldn't make it as an actor, and Schulman must have.
Should we set up an octagon fight with
Listen,
you two?
Robin Williams basically does like improv class exercises throughout this story. And
yes.
It's great. I love it. And it's for your creative mind where you just have to just be okay with creating whatever in terms of poetry jams. So if you've got a poetry jam coming up, go watch Dead Poets Society. This will help you come up with some material.
In that vein, one of the big lessons that Keating teaches is trying to get kids to come out of their shell. He has Ethan Hawke basically riff a scene while his eyes are closed and he's trying to drag it out of him. He has the kids recite "Oh Captain, My Captain," which is a big turning point in the movie.
That is how you summon the muse, by the way. just for the record, so that all that stuff works for
me. So he's very unconventional, and the administration is always having a bit of a side eye towards him because he's not doing things by the book.
He's teaching the kids through sports,
right?
And taking them outside of the class, and they're going. They have a montage where they play soccer, where they do again more acting exercises, where they go outside outside and be physical and not just a bunch of nerds tied down to a library.
And he cares about these kids, and you can tell that because Neil Peary, the Robert Sean Leonard character, explains to him how he wants to be an actor. He's being pressured by his father. His father doesn't want him to be part of the school paper.
He's got that great face where you don't know if he's laughing or crying. So yeah. Very, you know, as an actor, it really works. I'm not surprised he gets, you know, put in the starring role.
And John Keating tells him to basically follow his heart, be an actor, try it, join the school play, et cetera, et cetera. And Neil Peary, against his father's wishes, without his father knowing, does that and actually ends up getting the lead role in A Midsummer's Night Dream, the school's production of A Midsummer's Night Dream.
So I blame the casting coach and the director of the play
for having
more
him lose his
than
life.
Yeah, more than the dad from That 70s Show, because this is kid's first
maybe
role.
He was a master thespian.
He
nailing the lead.
That's fine. That's
in
fine.
In William Shakespeare's Midsummer's
Night Dream. He's a prodigy. But like I said, you look at his face, that's cult follower eyes right there. This is a kid who's touched. This is a kid who should not be given the pressure of the whole franchise, the whole Shakespeare Midsummer Night's
Well,
Dream.
He doesn't get the movie. He's not the kid that ends up getting the choice of the movie at the end either. Cause
no.
He's dealt with by himself.
The director of the play.
Is at fault. Yeah, he's the one responsible for this. He should have fallen on the sword. I get it. So Peary does the Midsummer's Night Dream. Everybody loves it. He gets rave reviews, and then he finds out that his father was actually at the show watching him, and his father basically
power
says,
play of the century here.
Basically says, "You're an embarrassment. Why can't you just be right?" He leaves him behind, essentially.
Well, and, yeah, you're going to military. Yeah, it's
yeah,
coming
puts
up.
Him.
You're going to military school. We're taking you out of here.
Basically,
you want to have a power play with me?
The biggest atrocity in the world that this kid followed his heart, right, as opposed to doing what the father laid out for him. So
we just watched Trump, the American Dream. What happened with Trump was he actually went to middle school,
military school,
put up with it, and then took over the world. So
became
this
president.
Kid versus Trump.
So Neil Peary could have been president if he just listened to
yes.
Red Foreman. Yeah, Peary responds to this pressure from his father, and his father acting like this. He actually takes his own life by his father's gun, ends up committing suicide. He rocks the school, rocks Welton Academy, and the administration basically forces the kids to give up Keating as the reason. The fall guy, essentially. Blame him for the death, for the suicide.
I did not make mention of this the last time we talked about it together, which means nothing to nobody, so you can cut that.
Okay.
Here's the thing with this scene. Like, we talked about it in the full Monty, going way back in terms of retrospectives mm-hmm. go. It's a seeming triumph when the kid pulls off the role in a Midsummer's Night's
yes.
Dream, right?
Yeah.
It seems like the biggest moment in the movie
followed
today.
His heart. He did it. He was a success. Everybody loved him. Yeah. Big moment.
When they're at the height of their mountain, you take that character and you rip them down.
Yeah.
And as a writer, Shulman does a terrific job here. Just when you expect things to be going swimmingly, he tears them down and the father drops the hammer.
It's
too much for the kid to take. Which, and again, this the suicide, who's surprised?
No,
I'm not surprised.
Not at all.
I'm not against that part of the movie. That makes sense. I mean, it's an abrupt tonal shift, for sure.
But necessary, too, because it creates the conflict with Keating. In
but
the,
absolutely,
again, the third
it
act.
Works. It definitely works.
Yeah. So Keating is fired, essentially. The kids are pressured by the administration to kind of say he was responsible for it, as the parents want them to make Keating the fall guy, and he's fired. He comes to collect his things in the middle of class, which some another stuffy administrator has taken over his English class for the most part. And you see the dichotomy between Keating's lessons being taught on the football field and how this guy comes in and says, "We'll start from page one." You know,
right.
And it's starting from the book that Keating textbook that Keating never used.
That he had the kids rip out.
Right.
Page one.
Right.
Right.
Keating comes back to collect his things. The kids want to apologize, especially Ethan Hawke at the end there, the one that's been repressed the whole movie. Keating says, "It's okay, I get it. Ethan Hawke starts by standing on his desk saying, "Oh, captain, my captain." Everybody else stands on the desk saying, "Oh, captain, my captain," in the face of the administration who's yelling at them to sit down. And
right.
That's kind of their big unification moment. And that's pretty much the note that we end the movie on.
The hollowest gesture of any climax in any Oscar-nominated film.
You're still fired.
And these kids are still going to Harvard, and nothing's going to change. But these kids stand up on their desk and watch the Saturday Night Live skit.
Robin Williams should have been like, "What are you doing? Sit down."
Yeah, well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, this does nothing.
You bunch of
you
assholes.
You gave me up.
Yeah. I mean, these kids are, given the dilemma, you know, stand up for me or stand up for this new way of life or, you know, rat on them.
Right. Basically. Right. And Mike said, watch a Saturday Night Live skit. There is a SNL skit from when Fred Armisen
one of her recent years. Yes.
Yeah. It is a parody of this scene, the final scene. It goes way off track. I got infinitely more enjoyment out of that skit, 3-minute skit, than I did from any part of this movie.
And again, we're in our spoilers here. We're not spoiling things as much as we could. So that's why I said what I said at the beginning. So what fucking year is this?
This did take place in the 1950s. That's what IMDb hints at.
That's what IMDb says. Because I couldn't tell if it was 1850, 1920, 1820, 1970, until
or
I saw...
Or The Village from M. Night Shyamalan's The Village.
Exactly. Until I saw those pointy shoulder pads, apparently...
Yes, that's right. Your defensive coordinator mind took over.
Yeah, apparently, like, the football kids just hang outside around the bus in full uniform in the 1950s.
How else are you going to know they play football?
Only weigh 120... Yeah, they only weigh 120 pounds, so I guess they could fit all their pads on. We have to put all our kids' pads under the bus, for Christ's sake. They have the things under the bus... Okay. The big doors.
Yeah, no, I know. Yes,
we have to store them there because our kids are huge. High school football players today are not as small as that.
No,
those kids
no,
have never
certainly
played football.
Not. That's absolutely
reminded
true.
Me of the little freshmen trying on pads for their first
they
time.
They are very, very scrawny, very young.
Yeah, give me a break. And then, of course, the cheerleaders. It's kind of a ridiculous scene. You have the motif with the birds. Many a times in this movie, they show flying flocks of birds, which is like the flock of students in the school that they all have to go together, and they all have to
David Lynch must have saw that and thrown up.
Yeah. But the birds migrating motif,
that symbolism,
that's all over it. Yeah. The teachers are kind of repressed too. I mean,
kind of
definitely.
they're fucking, they have no excitement in their lives. They're all fucking ready to kill Keating for just being an unconventional teacher.
Yes.
Never mind him being responsible for a student's suicide.
Any more notes that I have?
Well, we're going to talk about the worst scene, which is both of our worst scenes in a minute, which we've hinted at a lot already. Let's do our best scenes first. Because yours is vastly different than mine. I'm a sucker. I'm soulless. I'm an easy mark. My best scene was the O Captain, My Captain scene at the end. I think it worked for me, and I know it didn't for you.
I've tried to think about it more since we've looked at this before. It does mean something. And I know it's
a big emotional moment.
It's an emotional moment, and I think it means something that it means nothing. Right?
Because I disagree.
The industry at large is not changing. The world at large is not changing. But you know what? These kids, who are still kids...
It's something that it's the Ethan Hawke character doing it.
Right.
Because this kid couldn't get out of his own way at the beginning of the film without Keating's help.
What I'm trying to say is that it's a gesture, and that's all. But that's still okay. That's enough for these kids.
Right, because they are so repressed.
It means something as a gesture. Yeah.
Right, and it probably, you know, for him being so personable and being the one responsible for opening these kids' eyes to the world, to see them do that in the face of the administration, it's the typical, you know, damn the man, don't conform, be yourself.
Yeah. The country's
a big deal for him.
The country's still going to hell in the handbasket overall.
you have the macro view that I usually have with this movie. Nothing matters, everything is shit.
We recorded this last summer, so I had time to think about it. So, yes, I think, and then, you know, Ethan Hawke's character does a nice job of projecting all these themes.
The
outward.
Only problem I have with it is that Ethan Hawke's character was the one that originally gave him up and caved for the administration, basically.
Right.
So, like, you just sold him up the river. Why? What the fuck are you standing on your desk first?
All those, it's all correct, yeah. And that was my biggest problem with it, watching it last year. But then again, revisiting it, it still means something as a gesture.
It does.
It's as much courage as these kids could
and
sum,
I'm a sap with,
sum up.
With that
and
moment. So.
That's why I'm guessing that's why it worked for me.
Yeah, it did. That's exactly
I hope
right.
you have the same take on What Harry Met Sally.
Oh, I do not. No. I do not, sir. What's your best scene?
My best scenes were the teaching montages. I love the, you know, the acting troupe.
You are one that teaches youngsters too.
They really worked for me. Yeah, and he's a good teacher. You know, and he's got setups and payoffs in his teaching methods. Like, he will start telling a story to these kids about, you know, seize the day, and the big climax of that scene is carpe diem, and this is what
seize
it means, and
carp.
That's why seize the carp. It just really works. Again, I won't give you all the whammy moments, give them away, so you can rewatch this and enjoy that. But those teaching moments, they're excellent, and I think those I think a lot of that is taken from Thomas Schulman's acting classes. Which means he has good acting t-shirts. Good for him.
So you are, let's see who you've credited so far. Robin Williams, Thomas Schulman's acting teachers.
These are
that
acting
he hypothetically has.
These are acting exercises. I'm sorry.
You're going out of your way to not give Schulman credit here.
No, I'm giving him credit until he drew from his real life experience. Because fucking stuffy ass Vanderbilt didn't help him with that part of it.
We've shit on Schulman.
I didn't get into Vanderbilt. That's why I'm upset.
All right, let's talk about the worst scene, because it's the worst scene in the movie, and it's problematic and emblematic of what's going on with the Me Too movement today.
Jesus, yeah.
Knox, again, the young Josh Charles character, is infatuated with this girl. He meets this young girl at the house he's at in the beginning, the
Danbury residence next to Burberry Road.
This young girl's name is Chris, and he's immediately infatuated with her. Fine. It's a running theme throughout the movie. He ends up going to this party off campus, basically, which is like a mixer of different schools.
Where he meets his first girl.
Yeah, where Chris is at, and she's unconscious, basically, on the couch. She basically drifts off to sleep.
Yes.
There's alcohol involved. These kids are underage drinking. It's very prevalent. He goes to unconscious Chris and
has to fire himself up for it.
And because of carpe diem and seize the day, he kind of gives himself a pep talk. All of Keating's messages, which I'm sure he didn't mean to say date rape, but Josh Charles kisses the unconscious girl. That's problem enough. It's presented in a way that he's doing what he's supposed to do. This is what the message for Keating was. Ugh. Unironically, by the way. Like, this isn't presented as him doing any wrong. He's supposed to be the protagonist in this scene, finally motivating himself to go after his heart.
Right. Kiss an unconscious drunk girl at a party.
Exactly.
Ugh! What the fuck?
A guy in a football letterman's jacket sees Josh Charles do this.
The bad guy in this scenario.
Comes over to him and says, "What the fuck are you doing kissing an unconscious girl?"
But then he chides him on being a nerd.
Nerd, basically, yeah.
You're someone else. And then, you know, I mean, he's turned into a stereotypical bully.
Of course. And he punches out Josh Charles, but he's the bad guy because the scene calls for him to be a bad guy. Yeah. When in reality, he's defending an unconscious woman that just got kissed without consent.
Exactly.
It's so gross.
Gross.
It is a gross scene.
And the movie just like glosses right over it. That's an important
scene. Oh, it doesn't gloss over it.
But it
turns it up to a 12 because then he stalks the fucking girl going to her school and like literally showing up with flowers at a school that is not his to like, this is the problem. And this is, I'm going to lose my fucking mind with When Harry Met Sally. It's this goddamn nice guy, subculture, fedora wearing bullshit that these types of movies have perpetrated. They make you think that if you just beat a girl down to death with attention, she owes you romance. And it's bullshit.
Yes.
And it starts with movies like these and actions like these. This is a date rape. This is date rape.
Here's your Oscar. Put it okaying date rape. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's disgusting.
So that was both of our worst scenes.
Essentially, again, you know, what was our thesis statement going into the review, or at least that I wanted to bring up? It was that this movie is morally bankrupt.
Yes, without question. Without question. And you could make the argument that, you know, it was a different time. It was a different time. And it shouldn't have taken us this long, 30 fucking years from 1980, whatever, to say that, hey, maybe women should have equal rights and should have to give consent for men to be okay with doing these types of things. But you can see what a problem it was ingrained in society. This is an Oscar-winning film.
But here's the thing. It's not like it's doing this and showing you how screwed up everything is.
Exactly.
It's validating
exactly
these things.
Exactly.
It's
the
not
point.
Clever
yes.
enough to say, all right, this is how repressed these kids are. This is how screwed up their lives are.
Right.
And this is why. No, it's validating it, especially with the reactions of the Letterman's jacket dude.
This is how these kids from these higher class of people are supposed to act, and this is what they can do if they motivate themselves in an unironic manner. They can get whatever they want, right? Including women, against their will.
Who is literally just a passed out object of his affections in that scene. No, it's gross.
It's terrible.
Absolutely gross.
So that is putting a bow on Dead Poets Society.
Yeah, I just want to say one final thing is I think, you know, technically speaking, not morally speaking, you know, technically speaking, it is a well-written script. If you look at it, you break it down. I did that. Crisis, climax, all the big vocabulary words about screenwriting. This movie checks off a lot of those boxes. It does things very well. Like the one example I gave at their highest height, you bring them down to their lowest low kind
of deal.
Would
you like to apologize to Mrs. Shulman? Thomas Shulman's mother?
No, absolutely not. Right, because I think he's wrong. Just philosophically.
I don't disagree with you.
Philosophically, I think he's
it's
wrong.
It's tough to get past those couple scenes with Knox. And I know it's a different time and that's an argument, but whatever.
I guess we'll have to review Welcome to Mooseport at some point because I think that's going to be equally as wrong.
Here's your Oscar.
This is why politics should not be. This is how politics should not be. Damn it.
I'm running for mayor. Oh, God. Anyway, do the right thing.
Get out of my shower.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Do the Right Thing is next on our docket. And it is the Spike Lee debut, a movie that could have been made 2 weeks ago and had just as much cultural relevance and ring as many bells. Give us a production profile on Do the Right
Exactly.
Thing.
Exactly. I mean, think about it. How timeless, in a way, that Dead Poets Society tried to be versus how timeless Do the Right Thing is. Amazing. All right, Spike Lee's bio. Born in 1957 in Atlanta, Georgia, Spike is the son of a teacher and a jazz musician, the oldest of four children. They moved to Brooklyn.
And Reggie Miller's little brother.
Oh, oh no. Those 10 seconds are 10 seconds I can't get back in my life. Anyway, Spike went to Morehouse College and then attended film school at NYU. Spike was definitely a prodigy, making the first student film to be showcased at Lincoln Center's New Directors New Films Festival. The title of the short was Joe's Bed-Stuy Barbershop, We Cut Heads. That was in 1983. Spike basically just gets more and more work as he goes. He gets steady work. And
in
that's,
5 years,
he goes
from a beloved short making, a, you know, a history making
He makes
short,
a bunch of those shorts. Yeah,
to making Do the Right. In 5 years, that's unbelievable.
And it starts from those shorts to She's Gotta Have It, mm-hmm. which is his debut movie, very good one.
Turned into a Netflix series.
He's really never looked back from there. I mean, he's just made movie after movie. School Days, Do the Right Thing, Mo Better Blues, Jungle Fever, Malcolm X, Crooklyn, Clockers, Girl Six, Get on the Bus, He Got Game, Summer of Sam, Bamboozled, She Hate Me, Inside Man, Miracle at St. Anna, Old Boy, and Chi-Raq are all the films I've been lucky enough to see over the years. They're each impactful. They're,
yeah, as a writer, you're a big Spike Lee fan, right?
I am a big Spike Lee fan. I think he's got a very unique voice in terms of the narrative fiction. He's also done some great documentaries. Lumiere and Company, Four Little Girls, which is heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. Kobe Doing Work, a good basketball movie that we reviewed in our basketball pods. And When the Levees Broke about Hurricane Katrina. His 100%ers on Rotten Tomatoes include the new Netflix play/documentary, Rodney King, and documentaries Passing Strange and A Huey P. Newton Story, all of which I got to see sooner than later. I haven't seen any of those. Spike is the most famous New York Knicks fan of all of us.
Well, second to you.
Of all of us.
The audacity of you to include yourself.
I still blame him, however, and it's confirmed.
As you should.
In Winning Time, for hyping up Reggie Miller's final 9 points in 10 seconds when we lost in 1996.
Now, devil's advocate, as a true director, he brought the best out of his star, didn't he?
But his powers were used for evil. Just like Thomas Shulman's powers.
Well, not all movies can have happy endings, Mike.
Yeah. God. 9 points in 10 seconds.
Yeah, it's something else.
I remember not eating my grandma's beautiful Italian dinner after that happened because I knew we had lost.
I remember my father left. He went outside with like a minute left in that game because it was over. And I watched till the end, and Reggie Miller did what Reggie Miller did. And I came outside, and he was like, are the Knicks win? I go, no, Pacers won. He goes, what? Because they were down like 7 with a minute left.
Just like the hollow feeling in your stomach when something...
Well, not your stomach.
My stomach. When something unthinkable happens. Yeah. That happened.
Nah, I'm just busting your balls. But yeah, that was a moment.
Meatballs.
That was, and credit to Spike Lee's directorial career in the fact that that's not what he's most famous
for. He's a motivator.
Right.
But he's a, you're
right. He's done plenty more to make his namesake for.
Absolutely. The last note I want to say about Spike Lee, in the movie South Side with You, the white filmmaker had the character of Barack Obama and Michelle Obama on a date seeing this movie, right? They see seeing Do the Right Thing, that is. Their boss winds up being in the film with them, in the movie theater with them, comes out, and, oh, okay, hi, boss from my law firm, nice to see you. We're both your employees, right, and we're out on a date, yes, seeing Do the Right Thing. And the boss does this big explanation of, what do you think Mookie's... What do you think? Why was he so mad in that scene? Why did he do what he did? And the guy's like, well, he did it to save Sal, right? And Obama and Michelle agreed with him.
Oh, wow.
And then so he walks away and he's like, I don't agree with him. I just told him that because I think Mookie was just angry.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wanted to God, use that.
How about that?
In the movie Barry on, I'm sorry, South Side with You.
Yeah.
Barry was another one.
It was.
On Netflix. I thought that was fascinating.
What do you think the Trump movie is going to be called when it gets made?
Dead Poets Society.
Nice.
Yeah.
Got him! Got him!
That's a shameless Democrat humor.
Just but lost the, half
a lot
our
of
audience.
Democrats probably like Dead Poets Society.
A lot of Democrats?
Yeah. They like, oh, this is a, that is a beloved movie.
You mean the rich, like hoity-toity Democrats?
I don't know. Like, awardscircuit.com, people that we love, the critics that we love and admire and look up to, it's like their favorite movie.
I think we're ready to go toe-to-toe with them about it, because I that's a hill I'm willing to die on.
I think so.
All right, so let's do some specs for Do the Right Thing. Debuted May 19th at the Cannes Film Festival, went wide July 21st, 1989, directed and written by Spike Lee. Two Oscar nominations on the night. Not for Spike Lee, though. Best Supporting Actor Danny Aiello got the nod for Best Supporting. All right. And obviously for Best Original Screenplay.
He's good in there, but is he as good as Spike Lee in the movie? Is he as good as Samuel Jackson, Radio Raheem? Give me a break. Yeah.
120-minute runtime, produced by 40 Acres and a Mule Films, and distributed by Universal, made for a budget of $6 million.
Ossie Davis is in this movie, and he gets the nod over Ossie Davis? What the fuck?
Made for a budget of $6 million, ended up with a $37.3 million box office run, made about six times its budget there. A 7.9 IMDb score leaves it just outside the IMDb top 250, but I guess something's got to give so we can celebrate date rapists and the unprofessional men that teach them. 93% certified fresh rating on Rotten Tomato on 68 critic reviews, 63 of them being positive, with the average critic score of 8.9 out of 10. 90% audience score on 73,000, with an average of 3.9 out of 5, and a 91 meta score from Metacritic. So it's another highly beloved, highly embraced, and like we said, timeless picture from Spike Lee, who does play the Mookie character. And we are introduced to all these different characters in Mookie's neighborhood, which is the focus of this picture. We start off with the infamous Rosie Perez Fight the Power dance montage.
And that montage is not something I have a problem with, but it's her character is perhaps part of my worst scenes.
Yeah, you've had issue with the way she's handled this
movie.
So
we'll get to that.
And from that montage, we go to, you're ingratiated into this neighborhood. You meet Mr. Senior Love Daddy, which is Samuel L. Jackson's radio DJ character, Mookie, who works at the Sal's Pizza Shop. Danny Aiello playing Sal with his sons Pino and Vito. Pino played by John Turturro, Vito played by Richard Edson. They're the local pizza shop in this urban neighborhood with this clash of all these different cultures coming to meet. There's an Asian supermarket or Asian bodega that's on the corner that just kind of moved in. You have the bugging out character, which is a young Giancarlo Esposito, better known as Gustavo Fring from the Breaking Bad series.
Yes.
You have mother's sister, Ruby Dee, hanging out on the front steps of one of the apartment buildings. What The Wire was glorified for doing years later, Spike Lee did magnificently in making the neighborhood or the city a character. It's the whole basis for the movie, and it's fascinating.
I think Spike's strength as a storyteller in this film revolves around how he's able to portray rounded characters. And I know he's got crap from, like, Family Guy. This is a white person in a Spike Lee movie. Rah, 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 rah. You know, the Italian. No, I disagree with that, because Sal is a well-rounded character. Sal does a lot of good things for a lot of people. He is shown in many ways, like the Willem Dafoe character in Florida Project. He is shown putting up with a lot of Mookie's BS. You know, Mookie's taking him for a ride, and he's still a good employee, still a good employer, helping Mookie out.
He tells Mookie outright, you'll always have a place here.
Right.
You know, even though you're right, Mookie does kind of give him gray hair at times for being so outspoken. Obviously, it's whether or not Mookie's right, it's something Sal disagrees with.
He's trying to teach his sons to love the place they're running and to love the people that they're making pizza for. And it doesn't do a great job.
He opens up
that,
his doors after hours to some local youths that kind of that want pizza. And he says, they love my pizza. Let them in, against his son's wishes.
And this is Spike Lee's portrayal of the man. Yeah. As many bad things as Sal does, and he does do many bad things. He says horrible words. He goes after.
Well, he's responsible
and he fights
for the main conflict. Yeah.
He's responsible for that conflict, and then he breaks the radio, and he can't. You know, he just can't have the patience for that scene, and he won't reach out to Radio Raheem. That was one person that he just couldn't connect with. See eye to eye with there. So I mean, every character in this story is rounded. Every character is flawed, seriously flawed. And that's not just talking about the white characters.
No.
And the white characters are very, I don't want to say cut and dry, but it's clear.
Do you think it's easier to write characters that are so well-rounded if your emphasis, like Spike's is in this movie at least, is on the city itself and the heartbeat of the neighborhood? So you're not really concentrated. I mean, I know Mookie is the main protagonist, the main character.
Right.
But he's also, to me, the main character is that block, that city block.
True. And that's amazing that the whole city block, the love and the hate of it comes to into final conflict at the end. But what I think is most fascinating is you take from Sweet Dick Willie to Ruby Dee's character to John Turturro. Nobody is wholly right or wholly wrong.
No, absolutely not.
W-H-O-L-L-Y. And Spike does a very, you know, meticulous job.
Realistic job.
Of, giving you those dichotomies for each and those dynamics between each and every character.
That's one of my best scenes, is how he handles I mean, these are real people. These are people you know in your everyday life.
I mean, these are people who say, talk some shit.
Oh, yeah.
Some lousy, horrible shit
about,
you know, the guys on the corner talking about the Korean grocer. The Korean grocer talking to Radio Raheem and the horrible. They all act shitty to one another, and yet they're all portrayed in many ways evenly, some good, some bad.
And Mookie is kind of the conduit that brings everyone together, because you could see he's interacting with everyone in that neighborhood block, because he's the pizza delivery boy for Sal's. So he knows everyone. He knows everyone's backstory. He's talking with everyone of all different races, colors, creeds. He's the one that stirs everything, that keeps it going and tries to keep the peace for a long time. The through story starts where Bugging Out, Giancarlo Esposito's character, goes into Sal's and wants to know. Sal has a wall of fame on his pizzeria, and it's all white Italian men. And Bugging Out wants to know.
DiMaggio and
Sinatra, all these Italians.
Exactly.
Why aren't there any brothers on this wall? Well, you know, why aren't there any black people hanging on these wall of fame?
Yes.
And Sal's response is, it's my pizzeria, it's my wall of fame. So long as I'm here, there will never be a black person. Only Italians will be on this wall. Bugging Out takes offense to that, obviously. One thing leads to another. It subsides. So you have kind of this rising action where tensions build and they subside. And then the tension builds more on the following seeds and then subside. And it keeps coming up like a current, a wave, until it finally breaks through.
Amazing writing job by Spike Lee in terms of tension relief, in terms of, you know, positive scene, negative scene. It's a movie where you have to be in the right headspace to watch it, I think, and survive it. Because I think this movie can make you very, very aggravated, depending on the type of mood you're in.
Without question.
So you got to be up for it, I would say, because this movie will infuriate you, and it's designed to infuriate you, I think.
All the through line of that thread comes to a head. All takes place at Sal's Pizzeria, but within those rising moments of tension and conflict, you have the interplay between the characters. You have Pino, the John Turturro character, and Spike Lee arguing about basketball players. John Turturro is like the chaotic evil of this matrix, in that he just, you could tell he has disdain for black people. He hates black people.
He would have been the easy bad guy, right?
Right.
To cause the horrifying conflict at the very end, but he's not used.
No.
They use Sal instead, which is, again, is fascinating to me. And they use Radio Raheem instead of Mookie, right? It's not Sal choking Mookie or John Turturro choking Mookie at the end. It's Sal and Radio Raheem. I thought that was fascinating too. The big thing is, you have this through line where you're given such a setup for something good, right? Just like Dead Poets Society. Spike takes you to the highest of the high moment. They survived this ridiculously hot day where tempers were flaring all day, right?
Yeah, the heat wave is a big
deal.
Sal
is talking
to
his sons. Guys, we had a great day. Look at all the money we made. Look at this beautiful neighborhood. Look at these beautiful people that love my pizza. Let's let them in. Let's let them in and give them a last few slices. Let's do the right thing.
Right. I see what you did there. So
I didn't even realize I was doing it until I gave you that hard, that weird
Spike
laugh.
Spike Lee might be onto something. Radio Raheem comes in earlier in the movie. Sal's pissed off that the radio's so loud, asks him to turn it down. He finally eventually does, sells him pizza. Like Mike just said, the big crescendo. These youths come by after they're locking up. Sal says, they love my pizza, let them in. What Sal doesn't know when he lets everyone in at the end is that bugging out, since that first scene where he is kind of thrown out of Sal's for demanding a black person be on the Wall of Fame, has gone around the city or
right.
the neighborhood
the blocks, yeah.
to boycott Sal's. And he leads this boycott, which is not a boycott because they end up going to the place. So
right. The only guy they can get is Radio Raheem.
Right.
That's the only guy.
They call it a boycott, but they go right to the place. And it's bugging out and Radio Raheem kind of breakthrough Sal's with this last ditch group of people that are let in at the last minute, and tensions just rise and rise and rise in that scene until finally there's basically a full-fledged fight breaking out between Radio Raheem and Sal.
Yes.
So that started off by Sal beating Radio Raheem's radio with a baseball bat. So you have Sal and Radio Raheem going at it. The cops eventually come through or are called. It's a near riot situation because all the community is on the outskirts letting Radio Raheem itself fight it out.
It's a nightmare, and Spike allows it to become the nightmare that it is, where everybody's wrong, where Sal breaks the radio with the baseball bat. Crime, right? Where Radio Raheem jumps over the table, choking out Sal.
Yeah.
Crime, assault. All right. Where the cops, of course,
the cops come in. They choke out Radio Raheem. They kill him in a scene that is so like the Eric Gardner situation in New York that we just saw.
So again, crime. I mean, all these things going wrong, and he breaks down why it happens with this story,
and that pushes Mookie beyond his breaking point. And Mookie is the one that takes a nearby trash can, throws it through the window of Sal's, and there's a full fledged riot from that point on. The pizza place gets torn up and basically set on fire from that point. There's an angry mob of people. They turn their attention towards the Asian bodega that's on the corner. The Asian bodega, the owner comes out and says, basically, we're all the same. Don't do this. You don't need to do this.
Yes.
They leave that untouched. They leave the bodega untouched. And you fade to black and you're brought to the next day where Mookie goes to Sal's, mm-hmm. who's out in front of his now burned down pizzeria, and they just basically talk about, you know, they give each other jawing and shit talk because that's what these characters have done the whole time, and obviously right. ones they're both responsible for making each other's lives hell the night before, but they just talk about the weather. Time just moves on. Next day happens.
It's fascinating to watch what's said in this movie in terms of the text. It's characters arguing with each other, and yet in the subtext of what's happening, they're paying each other begrudging amounts of respect, right?
Yep.
I mean, when the subtext really works, there's other things happening than just the argument on the terms of the surface. And yet you have Dead Poets Society all the way to Crimes and Misdemeanors, which we'll talk about later. The lie of the text is that they're very mannered.
Yeah.
And yet underneath, they're doing all this
so
horrible
tension,
shit to each
tension
other.
And really so disdain for one another.
It's fascinating. And it's the city lifestyle, urban lifestyle versus, you know, rural, and, you know, the insidious nature of the rich versus, you know, the kind of working man's.
The characters life in this are just so well written that, like you said, that's a credit to Spike Lee. But I don't think there's any competition between which movie of these five has the best well written characters. I mean, these guys would just jump off the screen to you.
It's just so...
It's like a different class.
Specific.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's amazing because it's a framework of characters that lead to them all at the end, which we've talked about, like something like Moonstruck, right? How do you get all your principal characters
that's a good
in the
point.
Final
Encompass.
Scene at the end, all of them with agency, all of them playing their predominant role in the plot in the final scene? You know, that's screenwriting genius right there.
Yeah.
This is that, but more.
Heightened, yeah.
You have more characters to deal
more
with.
More stakes, too. Yeah.
More stakes. I'm very impressed. This is his masterpiece still. As much as I love He Got Game,
wrong.
Malcolm
yeah,
X, and Summer of Sam, probably my other three favorite Spike movies, this was his masterpiece from then all the way till now. That finale was my favorite scene. I think it's just genius how he pulls it off.
I don't think you could have I think there's a billion things that could be your favorite scene. Yeah, that finale is great. My favorite scene was the way he made that neighborhood speak. He made that neighborhood a character. It's something that takes a lot of depth touch, and I haven't seen it done successfully all too often. The Wire, like I said, is a great example. It's really the only other one that comes to mind to me, aside from this one. The way you're ingratiated right into that neighborhood, and you know those characters and able to relate to them on many levels, and how well written they are. Yeah, I'm all about this movie. That it's not a scene, but that's my favorite scene, quote unquote.
And again, you got to be up for this movie. Like, if you watch this in the wrong headspace, where you're not ready for just argument for 2.5 hours, argument that makes you pissed off because Spike is telling you that this is the good and this is the bad about these, about each one, every one of these characters, right?
Yeah.
And he's drawing it out, and he's doing it to for maximum effect, because it's gonna blow up in the end. So. You got to be up for it. This movie can be very aggravating, and it's been very aggravating for me when I've watched it in the wrong headspace. But I guess to get into worse scenes, I just think the Rosie Perez character, for her power empowerment dance at the beginning, which is great, mm-hmm. which I may or may not have copied in one of my short films by one of the characters.
Was it you dancing?
No, but it was
when we do go to YouTube, you know that's going to have to be our opening video.
No! Nobody will see again, although all my friends and family did a great job in that. Anyway, it's a lousy choice to make her such a passive character in the movie. And I feel bad.
I agree. I wonder if he thought that she accomplished everything she needed to with that day. Because that opening scene is so unique and so unlike anything that had been seen to that point. And it's been mimicked and copied. I mean, Broad City just referenced it with both characters doing it not too long ago in one of their openings. So I wonder, you're right. But I just wonder if, with all the different characters he had to deal with, if he thought that was her moment and was done with her, for lack of a better term, otherwise.
She doesn't run out of dance moves, I will say that, which is amazing.
She's awesome.
Which is amazing. She's awesome. But the problem is, the only agency she has in the story is the fact that she is, you know, his girlfriend, and she basically manipulates him into coming over by ordering a pizza from Sal's,
right.
Which is sad that she doesn't get.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but I also don't think it. You know, for me, it was something that was able to didn't take away from the script. My least favorite. I'm not going to be ignorant enough to sound like I can relate to any of these people on any sort of level. I don't care if it's Black, Asian, Italian, whatever. I'm none of those things, and I don't know what it's like to deal with racial tensions from those points of view. So I'm just going to say that my worst scene is when Harry met Sally.
You're a jerk. The other side of New York City, I guess we'll say. So we're getting into that. Well, I think you mentioned some things you didn't like about this movie.
You're
smelling your own farts. It's like South Park style, you politically correct son of a bitch.
Nobody sits on a fence like Mike One. And that'll do it for this episode, guys. We're going to wrap up and call it here. Part two. You are not going to want to miss, because I say some things about When Harry Met Sally that I can't take back.
It was crazy a year ago when we recorded it.
So we'll see what happens, but I'm going to lose my mind. You're not going to want to miss that. We will wrap up with When Harry Met Sally, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and Crimes and Misdemeanors, plus do our Perfecting Perfection, all in part two of the 1989-1990 Best Original Screenplay category. Be sure to reach out to us, like we say every episode, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MMN Oscar on Twitter, Machine, MikeMikeAndOscar.com, MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com. Anywhere that you see a computer, you type in Mike, and Oscar, you should see our smiling faces. Give us a like, give us a follow, give us a subscribe, tell your friends, all that good stuff. We keep putting these out as long as you guys keep listening to them, so we really appreciate it.
Help us spread the word about our show if you can. A couple clicks, they really do go a long way.
Absolutely, every single one. Part two coming soon. Stay tuned. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power. Algorithms designed to bounce with health and sense arrive. Designed to fill your mind now that you realize the prize arrives. We got the pump, the stuff to make it tough. From the heart, it's a start, a work of art to revolutionize.